We're reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, from the third canto, chapter 12, entitled Creation of the Kumaras and Others, text number 26.
Vridhi kamo bruva krodo lobas chadara dachada Asyat Vaksindavo Medran
Asyat Vaksindavo Medran
Nirti Payora Gastraya
Nirti Payora Gastraya
Ridhi
From the heart
Kamaha
Lust
Bruvaha
From the eyebrows
Krudaha
Anger
Lobaha,
greed.
Cha,
also.
Adara dachada,
from between the lips.
Asya,
from the mouth.
Va,
speaking.
Sindava,
deceives. No, not deceive, deceives. Medrat from the penis.
Niriti
low activities.
Payo
from the anus.
Agasrayaha
reservoir of all vices. Translation. Lust and desire became manifest from the heart of Brahma. Anger from between his eyebrows, greed from between his lips, the power of speaking from his mouth, the ocean from his penis, and low and abominable activities from his anus, the source of all sins. Purport. A conditioned soul is under the influence of mental speculation. However great one may be in the estimation of mundane education and learning, he cannot be free from the influence of psychic activities. Therefore, it is very difficult to give up lust and the desires for low activities until one is in the line of devotional service to the Lord. When one is frustrated in lust and low desires, anger is generated from the mind and expressed from between the eyebrows. Ordinary men are therefore advised to concentrate the mind by focusing on the place between the eyebrows, whereas the devotees of the Lord are already practiced to place the Supreme Personality of Godhead on the seat of their minds. The theory of becoming desireless is untenable because the mind cannot be made desireless. When it is recommended that one be desireless, it is understood that one should not desire things which are destructive to spiritual values. A devotee of the Lord always has the Lord in his mind, and thus he does not need to be desireless, because all his desires are in relationship with the service of the Lord. The power of speaking is called Saraswati, or the goddess of learning, and the birthplace of the goddess of learning is the mouth of Brahma. Even a man is endowed with the favor of the goddess of learning. It is quite possible for his heart to be full of lust and material desires, and his eyebrows... to display symptoms of anger. One may be very learned in the mundane estimation, but that does not mean that he is free from all low activities of lust and anger. Good qualifications can be expected only from a pure devotee who is always engaged in the thought of the Lord or in samadhi with faith. So one may be very learned in the mundane estimation, but that does not mean that he's free from all low activities of lust and anger. It is said, Balavan Indriyam Gramo Vidvamsam Apikarsati, that the senses are very, very powerful, and even a learned man may struggle. So therefore, learning is not the full protection. Although learning gives us the means by which we can detect how the more subtle forms of lust, greed, and so forth are affecting us. Because learning already makes us aware of the first symptoms, such as the dwelling of the mind on sense objects. Without learning, one is not aware of this and allows the mind to dwell on sense objects. But a learned person knows, now it is getting dangerous. Immediately withdraw the mind. Don't allow the mind to continue in this particular train of thought. Right? Cut here. Right? Because it will go deeper and deeper into contemplation of sense gratification. So in this way, learning can certainly offer us protection, and it is important and helpful, but never enough. One must really become the servant of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and therefore give up voluntarily his own comfort, his own preferences for the interest of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Whatever that may be in the context of our particular duty. But that, somehow or other, we must practice and learn to do. A certain amount of the amount of goodness is required for us, and that is part of our surrender to the Supreme Lord. That we are taking the arrangements that are necessary for a spiritual progression, for arranging nice conditions so that we can advance, that we take that very serious. In other words, spiritual life is never taken taken casual. I remember an old lecture which I by one of the present acharyas, I really don't know anymore. But anyway, we were on Sankirtan, and this lecture they used to play every day during breakfast, and the lecture was that everything is Sankirtan. That if you get into Sankirtan, then everything is Sankirtan. Otherwise, it's not Sankirtan. That's an old-fashioned Sankirtan lecture. Right? And everything you do has to be Sankirtan. And we always used to get lectures like that. But this was the ultimate Sankirtan lecture, because everything was Sankirtan. Right? But it was actually true. It was true. Thinking back of it, maybe it was presented or taken by us with some overzealousness, you know, some youthful enthusiasm, like, yes, okay, so let's go through the wall. And then the cartoon kind of cut out in the wall, right? Or with the sika still flapping in the cut out in the wall of the devotee who just went out. Not exactly in that spirit, but on a deeper platform, we have to see that everything we do is part of, is aimed at that result. That lecture was, everything you do is ultimately meant for that one action, giving the book, right? Giving the book. Now that was that one service of book distribution. But ultimately it is a fact that everything is meant to support us to come to that point of surrendering in service to the Supreme Lord. Everything. And once that is attained, all these things are not so important anymore. We're seeing that Madhavendra Puri was saying that farewell to my baths, farewell to my Gayatri, farewell to all my brahminical activities. Now I am only totally surrendered to the Supreme Lord. So this is the Paramahansa stage. We are aware that the Paramahansa sometimes take up the mood of leaving everything behind, even Varnashram, and even they give up their brahminical tread. Right? I thought I'd just tell you guys that. They even give up their brahminical thread and just simply serve the Supreme Lord in great humility. Of course, Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur established that for the Gaudiya Math. He took sannyas. He did not take Babaji in the same mood as the six Goswamis, who took this Paramahansa Vesh, this dress of the Paramahansa. But he took the ashram of sannyas to establish for the Gaudiya Math, as the founder acharya, that all had to remain well within the context of Varnashram. So exactly that very context of Varna Ashram is an intricate science of Vaishnav etiquette and prescribed duty, which is very important in our spiritual life. It will help us. Not that we put it over our Vaishnav identity. We are not the International Society for Brahmanism or other varieties of Varna Ashram. Varna Ashram is always a means of support. But all these means of support are taken as part of the shelter because the influence of lust and desire is all pervading. In this text of Srimad Bhagavatam, it is very interesting to see how the creation of the universe and the various influences within the universe, how physical that whole creation is. Right? How it's really like all just, when Lord Brahma is creating, it's not like some sort of wizard, you know, like a wizard and pop, and there it is. No, it is very much a, all emanating from his body. Right? And we're seeing that Lord Brahma himself also appeared in the same way on the lotus flower that emanated from the navel of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And subsequently we're seeing that Lord Brahma in the same way from his body is from his body is engineering the entire universe. And in the same way we see how we were born from a body, right? From the body of our mother. And in this way we can see how personal everything is arranged, and actually how the body is also an integral part of the arrangement of the Supreme Lord. We are the movement of, like, you're not the body, right? Down with the body. The body is an anartha, right? Prabhupada on one occasion said, the whole body is an anartha. Right? So it's like, my God, you know? It's all an anartha, right? A stumbling block. The whole thing. But then again, we can engage that in the service of the Supreme Personality of Godhead and transcend it. And that we have to do. That we have to do. Because there is no other way we can serve. Yeah? We have to serve through our body. I'm preparing already my seminar a little bit that I'm supposed to teach here during the convention, so I chose the topic of the Chaitanya Chandradoy Natak, which is basically once again the pastimes and activities of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, but this time written by Kavi Karnapur in the form of a play, which is very philosophical and deep. And very, very interesting details are in there. So there's the description of how Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is being worshipped. Oh, I lost the connection that I too much introduction, and now I forgot the connection with the point I had. But it doesn't matter. Lord Chaitanya is being worshipped as the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And it is most natural how he is being worshipped as the Supreme Personality of Godhead. He has all the qualities that are so attractive that everyone automatically begins to run, and everyone automatically, spontaneously begins to bring the paraphernalia for his worship. Then Lord Chaitanya enters into this ecstatic trance, right? He sits on the altar in the house of Srivas. He has revealed his transcendental identity, and he sits there in a trance for 54 hours. 54 hours he sits there. And all the devotees, they begin to feel, how long is this going to go on? It's all right for him. It's all right for him. But we need to serve him. Huh? We need to serve him through our bodies. He's like totally in an internal consciousness, and totally beyond the body, but we cannot continue like this. For us, he needs to come to external consciousness so that we can serve him. So please, my Lord, please, wake up. So it's a very nice point, because it illustrates that as long as we are embodied, we must serve the Supreme Lord through our bodies. Unless we go completely in the internal state of samadhi, beyond the bodily existence, right? As some exceptional devotees have done, who disappear just into some internal state of consciousness, fully meditating on the Lord, etc. The body had become irrelevant, right? And they didn't eat, and they just didn't die, and all that, right? It's like, but in our case, right? That might be an artificial platform. So, therefore, we must serve through the body. So although we're not the body, it is also through the body that we must serve. And therefore we must place the body in the conditions of the mode of goodness, to protect it, because lust and desire are situated within the body. Indriyano mano buddhir. It is said that things such as lust are situated in the senses, in the mind, and in the intelligence. So lust is there. So lust is there within the body and will attack us. And only one who can transcend that influence that will be beyond it. But in principle, the body has these tendencies within him. That, and as soon as one comes into a particular body, one very much picks up the instincts which are connected to a body. A dog. It's funny how dogs have particular things, right? Like, you see many dogs, they like to run after cars and bite the tire. Right? It's a thing in the dog psychology. It's as soon as you become a dog, you become attracted to biting a tire. And it's something to do with a dog body. It's a funny thing, right? A little trait in the dog psychology. So, like this, everyone has his, every creature has its psychology. Lately I've been speaking about the psychology of the ant, right? And I was contemplating on ants who are always working, and my conclusion was that ants must think that they're very important, that what they have to do is so important that they can't rest, right? You know how it is when you've got a lot of very important things to do, then you can even give up your sleep. But it's got to be important before you can do that. Otherwise, impossible. And if it's not important, you cannot give up your sleep. But if it's really important, all right, you know. We just do it. Right? We do it. So whatever the ants are doing is super important. Because, you know, at night you wake up, maybe here you don't see it so much, but in India you'll see the ants are working overtime, you know. And it's not that in the days you see all the ants sleeping, like, you know, like cats and dogs. No. The ants are working hard in the day as well. The ants are working, right? You never see an ant relaxing somewhere, you know, on the beach. Ants catching a tan. No such thing. Ants are basically workaholics, right? Total workaholics. So it's interesting to see that psychology, and you have to understand, They must think that whatever they do is so important. And how insignificant are they from our perspective? So small. They live so short. So how is it so important? A little grain of sugar, a little this or that. Big deal. How insignificant are we? And the poet Vijayapati said, Kuta chatra nana nana jara jara jivati. Mara mara jivati. Sorry. Kuta chatra nana mara mara jivati. How many four-headed Brahmas have already taken birth and have already died? So he's even seeing them very small. Right? He's even seeing whatever is so important in their activities as very insignificant. Even this whole creation of Lord Brahma, who, as we see here, when he passes water, it becomes the ocean. Like that. These things are described. Whatever Lord Brahma does has effect on innumerable living entities. Right? We cannot imagine how many living entities are within the universe. So Lord Brahma's tiny little moments that have the effect on innumerable living entities, and yet kuta chatra nana mara mara jivati. Yet how many of such Brahmas have died? So how important are they? Prabhupada writes about the demigods whose life a span is so long, one day of their time is 6 months of hour, and whose life is compared like bubbles in the ocean. Right? A few little interesting effects, and finished. It helps to become philosophical like that. It helps to look at one's own life in the context of transcendental knowledge. Because when we see our life is so small, so small, so ant-like, then our desires are also so small. Then everything, then our possessions are also so small. Then even our families are so small. Then our attachments are so small. Right? And when we see all that, then we can focus on what is really important. The Supreme Personality of Godhead. And how great is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Right? So how important is our relationship with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. In this way, by this philosophical exercise of seeing things in perspective, right, which is handed down to us by the Acharyas, and then illustrated by me with the little ant story, giving us the perspective of how important our own physical situation is and how important the Supreme Lord is. But we should not go into some form of denial of the body. That also is the other side. If you are in a movement which is always daily telling you, you're not the body, right? Then sometimes one may go the opposite direction and neglect the body. Or just push too much, destroy the body, actually. And this is certainly a risk for a devotee, right? That he may go that way. I always have to watch myself, right? That I take care of my body, because I hate taking care of bodies. I've always hated taking care of bodies. And I always thought, do I have to really take care of this thing? I hated that. Doctors, you know, ugh. Doctors, never. I hate doctors. I don't trust doctors. And how, you know, they always are so convinced they're right. And how do you know they're not making a mistake, you know? So I have great difficulties in surrendering to doctors, doctoring at the body. So taking care of the body is difficult for a devotee. Many devotees tend to take on all kinds of hardships and some go too far, damage their health. We have seen that, right? Devotees with monster book bags, you know, 25 books hardbound on either side, right? 10 years later, you know, the spine permanently dislocated, and permanent back problem, can never lift a feather anymore. So what to do? That doesn't make sense. We have to pace ourselves. We have to take care. We have to be fit. We have to be able to function. We have to function from a platform of well-being, not a platform of like, oh, being totally finished from all the austerity, ice cold showers in Europe in the middle of the winter, and 10 years later arthritis, arthritis, yes. No, I don't need a cushion. I'll sit in the cold marble. Of course, in Radhadesh, sometimes the marble is so hot. But sitting on the cold marble, same thing. It goes in the bones, right? So we must be sensible. We must take care. We are serving Krishna through our body. And we must engage that. And we can even engage our particular nature, our idiosyncrasies that are part of our conditioned nature, because a body has particular karma. Sometimes there's a big man and he says, I have to run, I have to, he has to use that power. If someone has a body like very powerful, he has to use it. Right? So we have to also engage the particular body that we have in the service of the Lord, as Lord Brahma was doing. And in this way, there is a very intricate connection while we are in this material world between the soul and the physical environment. And we should, through that physical environment, now serve the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Therefore, we should not shy away from dealing with the material energy. We must serve the Lord with the material energy, as long as our focus is within the material energy. So, being on the spiritual platform, being beyond the bodily platform, does not mean to neglect our bodies. Lord Brahma is also acting upon the desire of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Lord Brahma did not at all take pleasure in this part of the creation. In this chapter called The Creation of the Kumaras and Others, we see the description how Lord Brahma was not satisfied to create all these kinds of negative influences. It was not his desire to do so, but it has to be done. It had to be, because certain people just were at that state in their consciousness that they desired it, and the Lord therefore allows it to gradually be purified by various arrangements of the laws of karma. So what to do? So we also are facing that, not in ourselves, but also in our preaching, that we have to be able to deal with people who are afflicted by lust and anger and greed. And we have to deal with them patiently. And we cannot just become sectarian, right? When we become sectarian, it means that we become very closed. I cannot deal with these people. They're so fallen. Oh, they're so contaminated. No, we must somehow or other also reach out. It is very important that we are dealing with people who are in the material world, who are under the influence of these qualities, and that we somehow or other try and give them a next step closer to Krishna. Not too much, though. We must maintain a platform of security. But as Prabhupada showed, we must be brave to venture out and preach Krishna consciousness to the fallen conditioned souls. Alright, these are some points that came to my mind in reading this verse, and maybe I can invite some feedback from all of you.
Maharaj mentioned that Krishna sometimes, it says that Krishna protects his devotees, and we mentioned some examples where Krishna really show affectionate and give the devotees what they need. I guess you mentioned Madhava Dapuri. And then you get the opposite example of the devotee with the book, book back, having too many books, and depending on Krishna will protect him and save his body. So for me it seems it can be very difficult to find this balance on how much actually we should surrender ourselves and fully depend on Krishna, and how much we should understand that Krishna is not the one who's serving us, but we're serving Krishna. So how to find this balance?
Yes, one must be intelligent. One must have common sense. Common sense was very much appreciated by Srila Prabhupada. Right? So we should never think that we are above the laws of material nature just because we are in Krishna consciousness. No, we should never think. So since we are experienced with the modes of material nature, we learned a lot about them in our childhood when we got many surprises. Like I was crossing the Great Canyon and going by the rope bridge over the washing lines, hanging like that, and then they snapped and it landed on my back. I learned that, you know, that I learned something about the rope and a certain thickness required and all these things. I understood that very well after that incident. So you learn some things, right, as one is in the material, playing with the material energy. So we have that experience, that common sense, right? So one must use that always. Never think we are above.
But is it also like a play of all a show of our really surrendering? Because you know at Vedacharya he will not even go out and beg and not have a job, and is it also Tan Mahaprabhu we ask
for? Srivas.
Yes, I was Srivas type of and also Tan Mahaprabhu we ask for and instead I'm just clap a few times and food doesn't.
Yes. So if you're so surrendered, then it becomes more and more transcendental. But we are not so surrendered. Yeah. There's the verse Gopya Kama Bayat Kamsa Dvesas Chedanaya Vipa Vishnu Sambandat, and then it says Yuyam Bhakti Vayam Vibhu. So this describes the gopis. They had that special lusty arrangement with Krishna, lusty desires, and they satisfied Krishna like that. They were spiritual lusty desires for the pleasure of Krishna. Kamsa by his fear, Shishupal by his envy, the Vrishnis by their family relationship, all attained the favor of Krishna. And we, the ordinary devotees, by hard work and devotional service. So we should always think like that, you know, like be ordinary, very average, little devotee, but we can attain incredible perfection just by common sense and hard work in devotional service. And all these other amazing feats and activities of the associates of the Lord, wonderful, you know, let us pray to them. Let us pray to them that we, little ordinary fallen creatures coming straight out of Kali Yuga, if they allow, go back to Godhead this lifetime. Something like that. Common sense, that was my first point. There are more points. If beyond the realm of common sense, there's any doubt, ask you a spiritual authority. Take advice. A Vaishnava never decides alone. Then you'll manage to figure it out. So whatever you're not sure about, take advice. Ask the Vaishnavas. That was the second point. Yes.
This is about the yesterday's lecture. You said that the spiritual master is always looking over your shoulder.
Yeah.
And we also understand that the spiritual master is in your heart.
Yeah.
But how is this possible since he is Jiva Tattva?
Yeah, this is the mystical aspect of the relationship. That when I say the spiritual master is looking over our shoulder, it doesn't mean that the spiritual master is omniscient. It doesn't mean that the spiritual master may be now sitting in America and that he's looking over your shoulder, and that he's just seeing what you're seeing. Right? That's not the meaning of that statement. But what it means is whatever you do, right, you're not alone. And you have to understand that, take it as if the spiritual master, as if the spiritual master is looking over your shoulder, then you can see that whatever you do must be accepted by him. Would you do it if he was here? Maybe not. Yeah? Maybe not. Maybe you would do it a little different, wouldn't you? Huh? Yes. Would you say what you're saying if you knew he would hear? Well, you may say some things and some things you may not. So therefore, if one always keeps this in mind, my spiritual master, as if my spiritual master is looking over my shoulder, but the spiritual master is not omniscient. That Prabhupada made that point. He said that the difference between Krishna and the spiritual master is as good as God, but he's never omniscient, whereas Krishna is. So spiritual master, he may know or he may not know what is in your heart. Right? He may or he may not know, if Krishna reveals it to him. Sometimes a disciple very much tries to hide his inner life from the spiritual master. And sometimes they really try, and sometimes they're very successful. They manage to do it, right? And they hide. And of course they don't get any benefits from that. Because in this way, how are you? Oh yes, very well, thank you so much. Meanwhile inside, doubts are raging like a forest fire, right? So naturally, then, after some time, the doubts will get them, right? So, but generally speaking, one can see, even if you haven't seen someone for 6 months, you can see what he has been doing in the last 6 months by his present state of consciousness. Right? All his activities from the last 6 months may reflect in his consciousness. In this way, even if the spiritual master hasn't personally seen his disciple for 6 months, he may still, upon the meeting, see immediately. Right. Wow. And the test is there because in the relationship with a spiritual master, one has to be very attentive. We can never be casual. One has to be attentive. So if there's some neglect, some inattentiveness, then immediately one can understand, oh, some maya is involved there. Yeah. So the whole system of the relationship is very revealing. Right? So it's not always by mystic power. Don't look too much for mystic power. It's not about mystic power, Krishna consciousness. That's not the issue. It's just here and now. It's in this reality. Don't look for another one. We've got to do it here. On the ground. Any other question?
I want to ask how lust is manifested in Sattva.
How lust is manifested? That one word I cannot catch. Saffron what?
Sattvagun.
Oh, I see.
Because you mentioned that.
Yes. Yes, yes, yes. Lust in sattvagun is never expressed outside the allowance of the scripture. You see? So lust in sattvagun is either controlled, right? And is dealt with through a process of regulated activity, which are prescribed in the scripture, which help to control the lust, And lust in sattva-gun is allowed to be expressed according to Kama Sumi Bharatar Sabha, that special arrangement, that sanction, the Grihastha Ashram, and then all the principles, etc., that are there. So like that, only all dealt with in the prescribed way. Then it is lust dealt with in sattva-gun. If we, the lust may be there, but if we deal with lust in rajagun, then we go with it, you know. If we deal with lust in tamagun, then it may take, then we may allow our mind some perverted activity, which is destructive and harmful to others and ourselves. And we, Stoka Krishna, what were you had a question?
Just another question about the actual yesterday. You mentioned the first initiation is half initiation.
Yeah. Okay. It is said that actually the purpose of initiation is to bring one to the platform of Upanayam, and in which means the Brahminical initiation, where you are getting, where you're trained up in Vedic knowledge and learn to apply it under the guidance of a spiritual master, and then, okay, you get your initiation. So in the Vedic system, that was initiation. Right? But then in the Pancharatriki, it is a little different. Right? In the Pancharatriki, the person is not coming by his sanskaras. In the Vedic culture, you come up by your sanskaras, by your by being trained up in a cultured environment, and then gradually up on the, to the point where you can surrender to the spiritual master's guidance. Then you get trained up there, and then you get your upanayam, your brahminical threat, etc. In the Pancharatriki, there's no training at all at first, right? So you come as an untrained person who is fallen and who needs to be purified. So then we have the powerful means of the holy name, right? And that purifies. Then, on top of that, after the purification has been taken place, then one is more capable of entering into the scriptures, etc., and then also upanayam can be given. Yeah? So then we get the Brahminical initiation. At that stage, the initiation is considered to be complete. In another, therefore, it says that first initiation is only half, and the other is, with the second initiation, it's full. It doesn't mean, though, that if someone got only first initiation and never during his life gets a second initiation, that he cannot go back to Godhead. It is possible for one who simply has one initiation to go back to Godhead. It is even possible for one who has not been initiated to go back to Godhead. But it becomes more difficult. Because the spiritual master, it is said in the scriptures, in specifically Madhya Lila 15.108, Chaitanya Charitamrita, that verse that one can even, that the holy name doesn't depend on any external arrangement, and one always gets all, one can attain all perfection through it. But then I'd like to take the example of like the World Trade Towers, right? If you go in a skyscraper like that, if you go up, you can, without initiation, it would be by the staircase, right? By the staircase. But by the initiation, which doesn't mean so much the fire sacrifice, but by the commitment of the disciple to now act upon the on the intelligence of the spiritual master, which is superior, then you may be put on floor number 25, right? All at once, and then only another, another 100 feet to go, whatever it is, you know. So it's still a long way to go, but still, that initiation can lift up to floor 25. Same way, second initiation, right? Once we become more and more rabbinical, okay. Again, the spiritual master, we're going by the stairs, again the spiritual master comes by, he comes out of the elevator and says, okay, get in. You know, up to floor number 60. Right? Yesterday we took a couple, right? So it was an interesting yakya, we took a couple like up to floor 60 at the same time, others we dropped at floor 25. Pretty good. Can't complain. should be satisfied with whatever you get. But like that, in one sense, it's even in the Pancharatrika, it's important to have both initiations. And if one takes the first initiation, one should take that, now I must prepare for the second. It's the day you begin to prepare. I mean, or soon after that, you must prepare for the second initiation.
Most people say, you see that in different other groups besides ISKCON, they don't take first initiation very seriously.
Well, okay, the Gaudiya Math, to say it like the Gaudiya Math, they establish that point because they take more it from the Vedic texts. They take it from the Vedic context, right? And on the basis of Vedic tradition, is that Upanayam is the real diksha. Right? Diksha, Vedically speaking, was Upanayam. There was nothing. But you know, then one who has great faith in Harinam, like Prabhupada said, no. Harinam. It's Harinam. So that's where that difference comes from. You know, like, so sometimes we see that the movement of Lord Chaitanya is coming out of India, is coming out of Vedic culture, and is initially taking hold in an environment of Brahmanism, right? In Navadvip and then you get like still a lot of Brahmanism, like in Hari Bhakti Vilas, there's a lot of Brahmanism, right? And then eventually, it's like a flower that opens up, and more the glory of Lord Chaitanya's mission of Harinam Sankirtan comes out. And yeah, in our movement, obviously, that stands out so obvious because we don't have anything else. Yeah. So it's like, it's Harinam, you know, it is Harinam. What else is there? No, I mean, who has a few sanskaras? A few of the, of those who have an Indian birth may have a few sanskaras, but even they usually don't have that many. So who has sanskaras? Harinam. Harinam, 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 Evakevala. So it's very nice. So in this way, actually, the truth becomes more and more manifest. Because that's it. Harinam, Harinam, Harinam. Any other question? Okay. Thank you very much, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.